For the remainder of services, we'll hear from our pastor, Mr. Stephen LeBlanc.
Let's turn to the book of John, chapter 1. John, chapter 1. This is a subject I've given a lot of thought and attention to, and I thought I would introduce it by taking a look at this particular city of Bethsaida, which, by the way, was the city where Peter and Andrew grew up. It was their hometown. Now, eventually, it seems to indicate that Peter had his fishing business going on. He also had a home in Capernaum as well. So he probably had a couple of homes. And he was a fairly successful, probably a small businessman who was successful in what he was able to do with his business. So I need to find my way over to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. And we're going to take a look at this city which Jesus Christ castigated and was very upset with this particular city because a whole attitude had, shall we say, had dominated the city. In verse 43 of John chapter 1, it says, the following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip, and he said to him, follow me. Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. So I'm just introducing that to give you a sense of what we're talking about. If you go to Matthew chapter 11, Matthew chapter 11, and thank you, David Urey, that was a very good message. We live in this world where it's easy to get angry with people, easy for tempers to flare. And you can almost forget it's very important to God. God is a God of peace. And we have to grab a hold of that and not allow the flaring of our tempers to get the better of us. And it's not always easy to control that moodiness or the tempers that we can have. So I really appreciated that message very much. Let's go to Matthew 11. Matthew chapter 11. Let's go to verse 20, Matthew 11 and verse 20. Then Christ began to rebuke the cities in which most of his mighty works had been done because they did not repent. And he said, woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre or Sidon, they would have repented long ago. So there were some spectacular miracles taking place there as well in the city of Capernaum. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of a backstory there. Let's go to the book of Luke, Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. Why don't we go to verse 13 once again? Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. Had those mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented a long time ago. It's going to be more tolerable for these Gentile cities of Tyre and Sidon than for you in the judgment. Now, Capernaum and Bethsaida were on the northern section of the Sea of Galilee, and there were probably towns of maybe 8 to 15,000 people. So fairly good size communities for that time. And they were communities where a lot of fishing took place. And this is where they had their business. Now, this leads me to the book of Mark. And I want to focus on this particular story today. So let's go to the book of Mark. Back to the city of Bethsaida, which was not a good city. It was filled with a spirit of unbelief. And we're going to see today how dangerous that spirit is and how poisonous it can be. And unbelief shows itself in so many different shapes and forms, and it can be very subtle. But of course, unbelief is something that Jesus Christ is very much against. Very much against. So let's take a look at this story in the book of Mark, chapter 8. We're going to see a fascinating story here. In Mark, particularly, he goes into some detail regarding what took place here, because we see the hand of Jesus Christ working with this blind man, and we see what Jesus Christ does, how it is handled. And there is actually a delay in the healing that takes place. Now, we know that Jesus Christ was absolutely filled with the power of God. So there wasn't anything lacking in Jesus Christ. So what happened here? Why the delay? Let's go to verse 22 of Mark chapter 8. It says, then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought him a blind man, and they begged him to touch him. And we don't know if the blind man fully knew what was taking place, but someone else brought him the blind man. And remember, we're dealing with Bethsaida. This is a city of unbelief. This is probably kind of a jaded, maybe sarcastic city. They didn't really believe much. Apparently, there were some great miracles took place there, but the town was filled with a spirit of unbelief, a spirit of doubt, kind of a persistent doubt. And in verse 23, Christ took the blind man by the hand, and he leads him out of the town. There's a reason for him doing that. He wanted to remove the man from this context of unbelief. Probably people were sarcastic. There's an extreme negativity there. Cities and communities can be that way. Individuals can be that way. So Jesus Christ wants to work with this man, so he takes him out of town. So this had to take some time. How long does it take you to walk out of town? 15, 20, 30 minutes? It may have taken a bit of time. He was blind as well. I'm sure it took a little bit of time to lead him. In verse 23, he took the blind man by the hand. He led him out of town. When he had spit on his eyes, now this is interesting. You don't see too many examples of Jesus Christ spitting, literally, on the eyes. Then he puts his hand on, and he asks him if he saw anything. No one knows for sure why he spit and why the spit went on the eyes. There's all types of speculations. Saliva was a type of healing. I think my speculation is that it was a way of relating to the man, that he was relating to the man who could sense the saliva right on the eye. He didn't have to do it that way, but he chose to do it. It was very personal, this healing. He takes him out of town, so there aren't many people around. Then he spits, and the spit, the saliva, goes on his eyes. So there's a touching here. This is different. Christ would heal in different ways. Sometimes he would command a word, and it would be done. Sometimes he would heal from a distance, like the centurion's servant. He just gave a command, and so it was done. There was no laying on of hands. There was another time when the woman who wanted healing because she had been bleeding profusely throughout the years, she did not even get his permission. She just touched the hem of his garment without him even realizing it, and she was healed. He didn't give permission for that healing, but she was healed. Thus, her faith made a huge difference here. We don't know how much faith this man had, he was clearly in the poisonous city of Bethsaida. There's a lesson to be learned here. Cities can be poisonous. People can be poisonous. You can have people who are just filled with doubt or negativity, and they can obstruct a healing. Have to be careful. Healing operates within an environment in a context of belief. So he wanted this man out of that hideous city, and it was a hideous city. And in verse 24, so he looked up and he said, okay, I see men like trees walking. So the thinking here is maybe years ago he could see at one time, but he had lost his sight because he describes men as trees. Well, how would he know what trees look like? You see, so probably years ago he could see. Now we know there's nothing deficient in the power of Christ or his touch, nothing. Was it a case where the man's faith was being reawakened? I lean more on that understanding. So the man's faith is working here. So the healing, you could say, took place immediately, but it didn't manifest out physically immediately. I'll explain a little bit of what I mean by that. So Christ, a second time, put his hands on the eyes again, touching him. So the power of God, it's either going into the eyes or it's going into the brain. You know, they say we see through the brain. The eyes just work as kind of a way to bring in images, but it's actually the brain that constructs the images, and that's where the sight takes place. but we could speculate forever and nobody knows for sure. But definitely the second touch obviously made a great difference. Occasionally people will ask, is it wrong to be anointed a second time? And no, it is not. Doesn't mean you always have to be anointed twice, but it is not necessarily wrong if the person comes in faith. A lot of it depends on what has taken place in your thinking. I've known of situations where people have been anointed a second time. Loma Armstrong was very ill in her latter years, and she was anointed repeatedly, as well as Dick Armstrong was anointed repeatedly. So I'm not saying that's the standard operating procedure. There's no magic here. I'm not trying to say this is the secret recipe or something, but it is interesting this took place. Again, nothing lacking with Jesus Christ, but there was a bit of a delay here. But Christ is working with this man. Sometimes it takes faith to blossom, if you could use that expression. It takes time. We don't know how long it took between spitting and talking and bringing him outside of the city, probably relatively quickly, but it took a little bit of time. Then his sight is restored. Then he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into my word, poisonous Bethsaida. Don't go back to those people. They're filled with doubt and unbelief anyway. I don't want you going back there. This is how much God hates doubt and unbelief. But go to your home. So we probably lived on the outskirts of town. Nor tell anyone even in the town. This is so special. So very interesting to see this. So even though it seems that it was a delay, we know that the power of Christ healed that man. So let's understand the delay. You see, there are delays when God's people ask for a great miracle to take place, whether it be physical healing or any other request. Don't be discouraged when there's a delay. This is very important to appreciate. It doesn't mean the request hasn't been actually given. So this is important. Let's go to Luke chapter 17. Let's go to Luke 17. I'm just using physical healing here as an example. Luke 17. This is interesting, descriptive as well. Now, usually when people were healed, they were healed immediately. And in a sense, I would say that always took place, even though you could argue, well, the manifestation didn't show itself until a little bit later. In verse 11 of Luke 17, now it happened as he went to Jerusalem, he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers. And of course, they stood afar off because you weren't to approach if you were a leper, a hideous disease. And they lifted up their voices and they cried out, have mercy on us, Jesus, Master. And when he saw them, he said to them, interesting here, this is different. The healing takes place, but he handles it differently. He says, go show yourselves to the priests. And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed. Now, it took a while for them to walk to where the priests were located. This was not a two-minute walk. As they went, they were healed. I would argue that the healing took place immediately, but it didn't manifest out in their body, I don't know, 20 minutes later, 35 minutes later, 45 minutes later. As they went, they were healed. Nothing deficient in Jesus Christ, that's for certain. So as they went, they were healed. And then, of course, they spoke to the priests. They were cleansed. Verse 15, one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God. And he fell down on his face at the feet of Jesus Christ and he gave thanks. And he was a Samaritan. So Jesus answered and said, were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God, except this foreigner? Arise, go your way. Your faith has made you well. He doesn't say, my faith has made you well. It was their faith. And I'm sure it wasn't perfect. People don't have to have perfect faith to see a wonderful manifestation of a great miracle in their lives. But it's still a great example. It's a wonderful example. So we take a look at this. Let's go to Mark chapter 11. So because there's a delay doesn't mean that God's hand is not at work. And it may simply be a case that the decision has already been made and implemented, but we don't see the immediate manifestation right away, because the decision by God, in a sense, is honored, whether it be healing or some other deliverance or some other trial that we're going through where we request help. And that deliverance is there already. It's just you and I don't see it. But in the spirit realm, it's already done and signed, sealed, and it's already taken place. But this is where it's hard for us, because we're in the physical world. Everything moves slower. It's like we move in slow motion. In the spirit world, they move 100 times faster than we do. Poor analogy, but this is about the best you'll get as far as the description. Fascinating, isn't it? This is why we're told by the Apostle Paul, we're to hold fast to our confession of faith. You hold fast to the confession. Then eventually it manifests out. So to Mark chapter 11. Mark chapter 11. This is interesting. Take a look at this. Because this is sometimes how the power of God works, okay? It's already working, or it's done its job. But the manifestation is later. So Mark chapter 11 and verse 20. Now in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering what happened previously the other day, verse 21, said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. And Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God. Well, what's this all about? So let's reach back into the previous day and get the rest of the story. Let's go to verse 12. Mark chapter 11 and verse 12. Now the next day when they had come from Bethany, Christ was hungry. So this is the day previous. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, because it should have had fruit if it had leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. So he was angry. In verse 14, in response, Jesus said to the fig tree, let no one eat fruit from you ever again. And his disciples heard it. So Jesus Christ curses the fig tree, but they don't see immediately that the tree has died, right? But in a sense, it had died immediately because he struck the life vitality of it. But the outward leaves did not show death yet. This is what it's talking about. In verse 20, picking up the story again, now in the morning, the following day, as they passed by that same fig tree, then they saw that the fig tree was dried up from the roots, right? It's just like a healing. The healing could have taken place, but maybe the body is swollen or you don't start quite feel immediately better right away, but the root cause has been destroyed. Peter, remembering, said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. And then Jesus said, okay, you better have faith in God, for surely I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, so that's a command, you command the mountain, you attack it verbally, whatever the problem is, be removed and cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. So the command to deal with the problem, whatever that problem may be, a mountain is like a type of problem, you believe, even though you don't see it immediately take place, know that it will manifest out according to what you have said. Therefore, I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you have received them and you will have them. So it's an incredible lesson here, but you could see what seems to be a delay was in fact really not a delay. It had already taken place. Again, this goes against our thinking because we're visual. We want to see immediately where God says, don't rely on your immediate sight. That is not the way to approach it. In 2 Kings chapter 4, let's go to 2 Kings 4. Interesting again, why the delay or apparent delay? 2 Kings 4, so we don't want to waver in the faith. Now, this is fascinating. A couple of stories here. And I want to point this out because I think it's important. We know this woman is going through a great trial, and Elisha is trying to bring back the life of the boy. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 4. And we know that this child becomes very ill in verse 19 of 2 Kings 4. The child who was a blessing to this woman, she has a child, but then apparently several years go by, but then he becomes very ill. Something wrong with his head. He complains in verse 19, my head, he says to his father, and he dies. So verse 21, this woman then goes up and lays him on the bed of the man of God and shuts the door upon him, and she goes out. Then she called to her husband. So she doesn't even tell her husband. Who knows? Maybe he would have been filled with doubt. We don't know his level of faith, but she avoids him. Very important. When you're dealing with an act of great faith, you want to get unbelief totally away. You want to get unbelief totally out of the picture, out of the room, out of the context. Jesus Christ functions through the power that he has outside of a world of doubt. Anyway, so she goes to see the man of God. And when the man of God sees her afar off, he says to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman, please run now to meet her. Is it well with you? And she answered it as well. So she doesn't tell him. So she keeps this quiet that her son has died. Obviously, she's distraught, but she hides it. Now, when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. And Gehazi pushed her away, but the man of God said, let her alone. Her soul is in deep distress. But the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. Interesting, because this is Elisha. And the way Elisha processes this is that God hasn't told me right away what the problem is. Well, we don't always see what the problem is, right? We don't always immediately understand, even though we have God's Spirit. It doesn't mean we won't eventually understand. In verse 28, and she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? In other words, I asked for the son. You gave me a son, but now he's very, very ill. And now he dies. Why did you do this to me? She's very upset, troubled, and angry. Then Elisha said to Gehazi, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. A staff represented his office as being a prophet. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. If anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff, the staff of Elisha, on the face of the child. So he expected the child to be healed, but the child is not healed. My belief is the child is not healed for a couple of reasons. One, it is Gehazi who takes the staff. And Gehazi was a dishonest person. He was a man of unbelief. If you take a look at the story, you have to dig deeper into the story. He turns out to be somebody who's covetous, Gehazi. And I think God wanted Elisha to have that deep personal physical connection to the boy. And then we see the healing manifest out. In verse 31, and Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid his staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore, he went back to meet him and told him, saying, the child has not awakened. Then Elisha came into the house. There was the child lying dead on the bed. So Elisha goes in, shuts the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. So he's alone with the child, doesn't bring the mother in. Again, he wants to be alone. You know, there are times, particularly in a serious situation, you really just want to be alone with the person. You don't want a group there in the room. You want to be alone. You want to be totally focused on the person who's ill. You get people in the room and there are noises and just distractions that can come up. So even the mother is not in the room. This is life and death, obviously. So he goes in there, he shuts the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child, put his mouth on his mouth. He seems to know what to do. There's a lot of physical contact. It's as if the power of Elijah, which is literal, though you can't necessarily see it, is in his body. And as he prays, that literal power of God in Elisha is transferred to that dead boy. Remember when Elisha dies and his bones are in the grave, and then somebody happens upon those bones? And even in his death, the bones are so filled with power that that person is brought back to life again. Remember that Jesus Christ, when he was touched by the woman and he didn't know who touched him, he said, "I felt power come out of me." But you and I just don't see the power. It was that great. Similar thing here. There's a reason he's doing all of this. And he stretched himself on the child and his flesh became warm. And he returned and he walked back and forth in the house and again went up and stretched himself out on the boy. And the child sneezed. Life's coming back into the child. And the child opened his eyes. What a wonderful demonstration of the power of God. But God didn't use the staff because I believe Gehazi was no good and Gehazi had the staff. You get doubt out completely. You don't have anything in the way of interfering. And then he stretches himself on the boy. It was the physical contact and the power of God was then released into the boy, which was already there anyway. This boy was determined to be healed anyway. It wasn't something that God wavered in doing. That wasn't the lack. It was Elisha had to go there and touch him. And the power came. But even then, it took a little bit of time. It's just the way I think. I could be wrong. But there is, and I have seen this before, there is almost like there's a momentum that is involved. And then the fullness of the power comes into effect. God has already granted it thus, that it would be so. A little bit, and it's a poor comparison, a little bit like the blind man who was touched twice, but Jesus Christ, of course, was not lacking in power. If anything, it was the blind man whose faith started to open up, because it's not just you do something in faith. People need to receive in faith. You've got to receive in faith. There's a receiving element there. There's the pouring forth of the power, but then you have to receive the power. So in a way, there's the reception. But if it's an environment of doubt and unbelief and sarcasm and I don't think anything's going to happen, the reception isn't there, you see. And this is why sometimes the manifestation never takes place. Not that it wasn't granted, but the receiving never flipped the switch of faith on. So a delay, well, I suppose at the human level, yes, there was a delay. And then another fascinating story, and you could just see how all of this works. 2 Kings chapter 4. Again, going back to verse 1, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophet cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, but there are creditors coming to take my two sons." So this is a different story. And it's just a widow woman who has many creditors and her husband died and she was in a terrible way. And Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me what you have in your house." And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." And he said, "Go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty the vessels, do not gather just a few." So she has to do something here to receive the blessing. It's her responsibility to receive the blessing here. But she has to do something. She has to get those empty vessels from a variety of people. Why didn't God just immediately create all empty vessels immediately, which he could have done, and then fill those vessels himself? No, she has to do something. Peter, in order to walk on the water, I know it sounds obvious, but I think we miss this. When Christ said, "Come," Peter had to come, right? But his ability to walk on the water meant don't look at the wind and the waves. Stay focused, be single-minded. And as long as he was focused and single-minded, he could walk on the water, where Satan is always going to get us to try to focus on the physical circumstances. Oh, it's not working out. Everything's going wrong. I prayed about this before. It's not going to happen. Maybe God won't bless me. Maybe God's angry with me. You see, you have all this stirring, all these clouds, like layers of fog that hit the human mind. And then people take their minds off of God's desire to bless, and then they don't receive. You have to be ready to receive. You take a hold of the determination to receive. I know this sounds a little strange, but it's clear from the scripture. You must receive. So she receives and she does what she's told to do. And when you have come in, shut the door behind you, you and your son. Again, it's private. And in verse 5, so she went from him and shut the doors behind her and her son. Now, what you get a sense here, now we don't know for sure, but I would imagine she just went to all friends and neighbors and just requested. I don't think she explained every detail to everybody. Well, this man came and he told me to do this. And that's kind of the human way. We got to let everybody know at the human, because doubt will overanalyze. Doubt almost always overanalyzes. You overthink it. Doubt enters in subtly into the human mind, and then you break, shall we say, the current of the power of God, and then it doesn't manifest out. Not through lack of willingness, but you've allowed doubt in. You got to fight that beast everywhere it's at. And sometimes it's very, very subtle, and it could be in somebody you love. It could be somebody else you love, and maybe even you respect, but they just start to fill your mind with doubt, or it could be our own doubt. You got to fight that evil beast of doubt and constantly be aware. But she does what she's told. And in verse 7, then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debt. And it just miraculously filled. It was incredible, wasn't it? I mean, it was just an incredible miracle. And now it took time. I'm just saying, sometimes the way God works, there are lessons to be learned as we work our way from the request, which is often, I think, actually granted, but it may take some time before we see the physical manifestation of the request. I know, again, it's different, but God's trying to teach us, don't walk by sight. Stop walking by sight. And it's a wonderful story. So there are several other examples. Why don't we go to Hebrews chapter 10, Hebrews chapter 10. We have to be more sensitive to the fact that we are in a hostile world. This is Satan's world, and not everything will be given to us immediately or without hindrances or without roadblocks, because he's going to resist, because it's his world, and he will resist us in our determination to receive from God. So if you go to Hebrews chapter 10, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. So we hold fast to our confession, just as the men of old did, just as Abraham and Sarai did. They held fast to the confession, even though it took time to see that she would have a child from her own flesh, through her own body. But you have to hold fast to the confession. And that is very important, that we hold fast to that confession. Why don't we take a look at Daniel chapter 10? Daniel chapter 10. Remember, Satan's going to resist us. It's his world. We live in a world of negativity. You've got other human beings that will often be negative, even though you can love them. And in many ways, they can be good people, but they can be very negative. Sometimes we take a look at past experience and we think, well, that didn't happen or that didn't work out. And we allow our past experience to dictate what is going to happen and what should not happen. But that's past experience. That's not faith, right? You can't look upon past experience. That's dangerous. But of course, we know with Daniel, and we've gone through this many times, but you have to appreciate, even though there was a delay, it doesn't mean the request was not granted. Daniel chapter 10, Daniel chapter 10. In those days, verse 2, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came to my mouth, a type of fasting, and I didn't anoint myself for 3 whole weeks. So he wants to understand. He's trying to gain understanding, but the understanding does not come. People will say, well, my prayers aren't getting anywhere. But that isn't necessarily true. You're going on human feeling. I mean, is that how you base whether or not God has heard your prayer, because you have a feeling? Seriously, is that what you base your faith in, your feelings? How many times does he have to tell us, stop trusting your feelings? They come and go. You grab a hold of the word of God and you work through those layers of feelings, layers of, well, I don't think much is happening right now. Well, I don't know the past. Oh, I know so-and-so. They had that and they died in 6 months. All the nonsense that humans grab a hold of. And then faith can't work. God hates unbelief. It denies Christ as Savior and Deliverer. Unbelief is evil and satanic, and it can be very subtle. Fight it, and God will help us to fight. Hold fast the confession. So, Daniel chapter 10, he battles for 3 full weeks, but he does not give up. Then finally, after about 3 weeks, then there's a manifestation. Verse 4, now on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Ephah. So it's incredible, stunning visual manifestation here. His body was like beryl. His face was like the appearance of lightning. And I, Daniel, was alone in the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell among them. So they couldn't see, but they knew something was happening and they were overwhelmed. Therefore, I was left alone when I saw the great vision. And I heard the sound of his words. And while I heard the sound of his words, I was in a deep sleep. Suddenly, a hand touched me, verse 10, which made me to tremble on my knees and on the palm of my hands. And he said to me, Daniel, greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you by God himself. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. And then the angel said to me, Gabriel, most likely here. In verse 12, then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard and granted. Very first day, day one of prayer, was granted. It didn't show itself until roughly 21 days later. Why? Because there were spirit beings blocking the answer to that request. Now, the Apostle Paul knew how it worked. He understood the unseen world. I do think in the church, I include myself, we are just still naive to the unseen world we live in. Most of us, if you have fairly good health and according to God's blessing, you're taken care of financially and you live in a fairly safe neighborhood, we can be lulled to sleep that, you know, the world's okay. It's not great, but it's okay. When really this is Satan's world. Millions suffer. It is a polluted, vicious world. It's just God has protected us. Thanks be to him. And so we can lose touch with the reality. This is Satan's world. He's a hateful, hindering spirit. He's limited in terms of what he can do to us. And there are evil angels that seek to cause doubt and hindrances. And those evil spirits can infect other people and move other human beings against us. And those evil spirits often work in such a very subtle way. And I'm thankful for the blessings God gives us, but let us not be naive. Now, Paul was not naive, and we've used this example before in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul wanted to see the Thessalonians. He really did. He had made the plans. It was a good thing. It was God's will. But in verse 18 of 1 Thessalonians 2, the Apostle Paul said, therefore, we wanted to come to you, even I, Paul, time and again. But Satan hindered us. Something happened, maybe the travel, maybe bad weather, maybe problems in the church, wherever he was working with at the particular time, that there's a hindrance there. And it was never a case that God was not in favor of him going there. But Paul knew he had to work through those hindrances. And we have to understand as well that we have to work through these hindrances, that it's not everything is simple and easy, but it doesn't mean that God has not granted the request, and it doesn't mean that the delay is necessarily of God. We have enemies, and we should be aware of that, yet we should not give up. So if you take a look at 2 Samuel, let's go to 2 Samuel. I want to bring another point to your attention. Let's go to 2 Samuel. I believe it's in chapter 23, 2 Samuel 23. This is important. I brought this out just recently, but you have to appreciate that God wants us to learn to hold fast in our faith, because there will be storms, or sometimes you get to work your way through layers of resistance because we're in Satan's world. And 2 Samuel chapter 23, remember speaking about the mighty men and how this incredible man called Shammah, the son of Agi, the Hararite, he confronted the Philistines who had gathered together in a troop. And there was a piece of ground full of lentils. And all the people fled from the Philistines. So this is on ground. It may have been his land. We don't know for sure, but there were many Philistines. And most everybody ran away. They were afraid. But he planted his feet. He stood fast, according to one translation. He stood his ground, verse 12, he stationed himself in the middle of the field, defended it all on his own, and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. So when you're in the middle of the storm, when it seems like circumstances are against you, or you start to be entertained with doubt, well, maybe God's not here, or maybe this is not what I'm to be doing, or I'm not to be blessed in this way. Understand, you're in a spiritual fight. You are in a spiritual fight. You stand your ground. You plant your feet. You fight, and you just start wielding the sword, which is the word of God. And you cleave to that sword, and you say, I don't care how bad it looks now. I don't care if it appears like I'm drowning. No. You say no. You've got to say no, though. He doesn't do all of the fighting for us. I realize there may be those occasions, you know, when extreme difficulty where you say, well, I've done everything I can do. I can appreciate that. But I'm just trying to make the point that we need to be like this man and to plant our feet and let the Philistines come, and God will strengthen us, because he wants to teach his children to fight. This is why you get the whole armor of God issue, where Paul's talking about put on the armor of God. It's real. It's not just figurative language. It's not just religious words. It's literal. We are in a spiritual fight. So important to never forget that. Understand, we live in the city of Bethsaida, and there's doubt all around. I mean, the world's filled with doubt. You listen to the news, it's so negative. It's a spirit of unbelief, of hostility. Like you said in the sermonette, there's not much peace. And all of that can stop faith from doing its wonderful work. You got to fight it, and God will give you that strength. It doesn't matter how bad it looks. It doesn't matter how many layers of clouds there are. It doesn't matter how long you've had to endure. Let us remember, the delay is not of the Lord. It is ours to maintain the hold of the request and faith. And God will bless us and work with us. And this is faith, and this is pleasing to him. With that, I will conclude today's message. Enjoy the rest of the Sabbath.